Get those searchlights up on the tower. Right now. Move, move.
I listen to 2ARM, 92.1 FM, in the car and at work, for great tunes and community news.
Welcome. I'm Herb, and we've got Community Spotlight here at 2ARM 92.1 FM, your local community radio station. And I have a guest in today, Maria Hitchcock. Good morning, Maria.
Morning, Herb.
Thanks for coming in for Community Spotlight. So you might start by telling me, how long have you been in Armidale?
Yeah, I've been in Armidale for 50 years. We arrived at the beginning of 1974, ostensibly because my husband got a job as a teacher at New England Girls' School.
And how long was he a teacher at New England Girls' School?
Over 30 years. He was the Mr. Chips of NEGS, and he taught maths. He started their IT system going and taught geography and a few other things, but ostensibly he was a mathematics teacher.
Now, where did you first reside when you came to Armidale?
Well, we'd already bought a small acreage out at Tumeric before we arrived, so we rented a place and then a year later we built the house out there and moved in around Easter of 75. By that time my first daughter had been born, so I was a stay-at-home mother.
Now, what did you first do when you came to Armidale?
Well, we needed to start getting to know people, so I joined a craft group that was operating out of St. John's at NEGS, and there were probably about 50 to 60 people involved in that, doing all manner of crafts, and I got to know quite a lot of people, some close friends, and that was fantastic. And in 75 I started an external degree at UNE, a BA, and my first subject area was German because I have a few relatives back in Europe and I wanted to correspond with them.
So was that craft group like a co-op?
It was a very loose association of different crafts. They did have a committee that, you know, took money and managed the organisation. I pulled out when my daughter was born, and I think those groups just went on to be like the spinners and weavers. I actually learned how to spin and weave at that time, which was fabulous, but the pottery group and so on, and they all went off to their own groups.
All right, so it might have been a collective of different types of crafts and arts, but then as it developed and people wanted to make their own little groups, like the Armidale Art Society, like the,
yes,
Pottery Society.
Exactly. And the other thing was that NEGS decided they wanted to use St. John's for a primary school, and so that meant that they ran out of a venue.
Oh, that's great. So what did you get up to after? So you were doing your degree, your BA in German.
Mm-hmm.
What did you get into there?
Okay, so, obviously, I had a young child and, you know, we had 8 acres and didn't quite know what to do with it. We built this house and we're trying to settle in. And I'd been a member of the Australian Plant Society. In those days it was called Society for Growing Australian Plants. Just a few months before my second child, my son, was born in 77, I got word that Nyla Parry was coming up from Gosford to start up an Australian plants group up here. And so I was one of the founding members of that, and I've been a member of it ever since. I'm actually a life member now.
So what is it about growing Australian plants that floats your boat?
Well, it's funny, isn't it? I was a migrant child. I came to Australia when I was 3, and my father was employed by the government for 2 years, and I went through migrant camps. And then at the end of the 2 years, he rented a house at Woi Woi Bay and plonked my mother and 3 little children there while he was working in Sydney. The children of Woi Woi Bay, it was a fishing village at that time, we just got together in a big gang and we roamed through the bush, and I think that was how it all started. You know, I sort of developed this intrinsic love for the bush right from when I was a little kid.
So we have a bit of a connection, you and I, with Australian plants.
We do.
And my connection is the Geimere lily.
Yes.
Having been surprised to me, I grew some Geimere lilies and one actually flowered one year. And I think it was it the first that's been documented here? I'm not sure.
I think it probably was. I think you're very clever. No one else has been able to do it.
Well, I can report that I've got four Geimere lilies that are in good health, but not one of them has flowered since.
No, and they're very specific as far as their flowering requirements are concerned. I mean, they grow naturally on the coast where they get a lot of humidity and obviously that warm temperatures, warm soils, all of that, which, you know, it's very borderline up here to do that.
So you grow a lot of Australian native plants, or you have grown. Tell me about that process.
So as a member of the Australian Plant Society, no one was growing native plants when we came up, and people thought we were a bit crazy for wanting to do it because of our very cold winters. You know, once our group got going, we started to run flower shows. We got together and grew lots and lots of different kinds of native plants. Our first flower show, we had a line going around the block wanting to buy these plants, which just had never been available before. So there was obviously big demand up here, but they just weren't available apart from through our group. And so we did that for a number of years, and then gradually I got interested in one particular genus, the Corias, and I ended up being the leader of the Coria study group in Australia. That meant having a membership right across the nation and running lots of field trips, doing a lot of collecting for botanic gardens and essentially, you know, documenting all the Corias. And as a result of that, I wrote a book, the Coria book, and became known, I suppose, as a national expert on Corias. And I still have the national collection in my garden. And that's been very interesting. It sort of, you know, kept me going for quite a long time.
So the Coria, now I told you before that I love the honey eaters. Now, when the Corias are in flower, the honey eaters love the Coria flower. And the Coria is not a hard plant to grow, or the ones in my garden.
No, that's
right. Thrive on neglect.
Yeah, well, they've got a little tubular flower and they've been documented to have a very high load of nectar when they're flowering. So that's why they're really attractive to honey eaters. And, of course, most honey eaters have a fairly long beak so they can get right into the nectar. The parrots, of course, cheat and they pull off the flower to get at the nectar. So you can come out in the morning and see all the flowers on the ground, you know, around a particular plant. But, yeah, so Corias, people weren't really growing them much until I started the Coria study group up here, and now they're really commonplace. So that was the whole point of the group, was to promote them and trial whole new varieties and then spread them out.
So just on the last point, they do handle the frost pretty well.
Yes. Now, not all species, but and at the moment I'm doing a lot of grafting trials, because it's not only the frost, it's also the soils. And some of them are quite difficult to grow in our soils. And so these grafting trials are proving to be quite successful. And that means that you'll have plants which will survive. Normally they only survive on their own roots for a couple of years. Now, you know, we can get them to extend their life to 20 or 30 years.
Tell me about the flannel flower.
Right, so the flannel flower, for about 150 years, people couldn't grow them. The seed is covered in these what we call hydrophobic hairs, which stop water from penetrating to the seed. And on the coast, the seed falls into the sand, and I assume little animals sort of crawl through the sand, abrade the hairs off the seeds, and then the seeds germinate. And in the early days, people tried burning off the seed because they noticed that flannel flowers do very well in areas that have had a bushfire through, but that wasn't really successful. And then a friend in Geelong, a German lady, had been doing some trials, and she cracked it, and she decided to use wetter soil, and that was it. The wetter soil helped to penetrate to the seed, and suddenly she had germination of seed. So there are 21 species of that genus, the Actinotus genus, and there's only about two or three species which are able to be germinated. People have tried just about everything, you know, to try to germinate some of these others, but they form dormancy very quickly, and it's one of those things where in some places some of those species will probably just die out.
So tell me, did you have a nursery with the Australian Plant Society out at this block?
Yes, so I started a nursery, but small scale, and I was selling through markets sort of back in the 80s. And then I started teaching at Armidale High School and had to give that away. But I revived it again when I retired, 2007. And I started selling through markets and hit a drought, and that was a disaster. And my husband advised me to just go online. So then I built up an online nursery, and that's not easy because you're competing with every nursery in Australia that's got an online presence, just the local ones. But I built up a very dedicated clientele. You've got to have an edge, so you've got to be producing things they can't get anywhere else, and you've got to produce quality, and you've got to also be very service oriented. So treat your customers like friends, and make sure that the transport is well organised. So I found a courier within New South Wales who was fantastic, and then anyone interstate I would have to send through Australia Post. Of course, that became a problem during COVID because, especially at the beginning of the COVID pandemic, I would send a parcel away and it wouldn't arrive because all the parcels were log jammed in depots, and so I was chasing parcels around. And one in particular that I remember was a lady who'd ordered something like half a dozen waratahs, and these were quite expensive plants, and I sent them off, and they arrived 3 weeks later, would you believe? And of course she was panicking, and I gave her instructions of, you know, how to revive them and so on. They arrived in perfect condition. So after that, people just kept complimenting me on the way I packed my plants.
So that sounds like a great success story that other people would probably know, would probably like to know about the online selling of plants. So you've had a really successful experience doing that. Maybe you should write a guide to anybody who wants to get into online selling of plants.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, first of all, you've got to be an expert in your field, right? So it's not just a case of wanting to run a business. You've got to be an expert in your field. And then secondly, there were things like creating your own website. You've got to have control of your website, because if you don't, your website is often out of date. And I would update my website almost every day. So as I had a new plant that was, you know, available for sale, I would then add it to my inventory on the website. And so anyone coming to the website would see, oh, yeah, that's an interesting plant, right? I might order that. And as well as that, you've got to know about marketing. So I bought some marketing software, and about once a month I would send out a marketing email with new additions to the nursery and maybe some tips and tricks, and I used to get quite a lot of sales through that. But the problem, of course, is that circumstances happen which are beyond your control. So COVID struck, and suddenly my sales tripled, and I found myself being run ragged because I was doing a lot of my own propagating, and I would spend the entire weekend packing boxes, and then the rest of the time I'd be doing cuttings, putting in seeds, potting on and so on. You know, I didn't have any time for anything else. I'm retired, so why am I working so hard? And this was, you know, because people were in lockdown in Melbourne and Sydney, and what did they do? They gardened. And so they went online and bought plants. And I decided then that, no, it's time to give it away so that I could dedicate my time to doing the research that I wanted to do. So at the moment I'm doing a lot of grafting, and no one's cracked grafting Waratahs, and I'm in the process of that. Fingers crossed, I've had a bit of success. So, you know, that's the sort of thing that I'm really interested in.
Were wattles a bit of your passion as well?
Yes, so what happened with that was that I was always very interested in wattles, and of course when you're trying to set up a native garden in New England, I learned pretty quickly that you use wattles as a nursemaid crop to protect the other plants coming through, right? And I know you've done that yourself. And then in about 86, I think, I was approached by Thelma McCarthy and her daughter, who asked me if I knew the words of the wattle song. And I said, oh, I never heard of it, but I'll tell you what, I'll have a look, right? So I had a look, and I came upon this incredible treasure trove of historical information about the role of wattles in the Australian society and the patriotism, and, you know, and I thought, this is amazing, right? I decided I'd run a campaign, and I wrote to the Prime Minister because, you know, Wattle Day had been mentioned, but obviously wasn't official. So I wrote to the Prime Minister and said, look, I think Wattle Day should be gazetted what they do. And I got this amazing letter back saying that, well, actually the emblem hasn't been officially recognised. And I thought, this is amazing. People have been just assuming that they had a national emblem and had never been formally recognised. So I changed the campaign, tried to cover both things. I then enlisted the aid of Macca on the ABC's Australia Alive, and he was absolutely brilliant. So we started to get a lot of support around Australia, people writing in to the Prime Minister. They wrote to me. In the meantime, I collected a lot of the songs, the poetry, went through all the school magazines, and then in 88, I got wind of the fact that Senator Richardson was coming up to Armidale for a Labor Party do. So I asked Thelma if she could arrange for me to have 5 minutes with Senator Richardson. So at Armidale Racecourse, on one of the little park benches, I sat next to Senator Richardson for 5 minutes and convinced him to do the emblem and Wattle Day. A few months later, I got word that the emblem was being officially recognised that year, right, and they had a ceremony on the 1st of September in Canberra. And at that time, the people from the department, I said to them I was thinking of doing a book, and they said, great, we'll publish it. So that's how the first Wattle book got published. At that ceremony, I talked to Senator Ray, and I said, what happened to Wattle Day? Because we've got the emblem, but no, nothing about Wattle Day. He said, oh, no, you'll have to do that yourself. So for the next 4 years, I wrote to every Premier, Chief Minister. If I got a negative answer, I'd turn around, write another letter. And finally, I got all the letters agreeing, sent them off to Canberra and said, now do it. And they did, much to my surprise. Yeah, but that's how it all happened.
So two things. It tells me that perseverance,
absolutely,
is the key. But thank you for all your efforts and getting Wattle Day recognised, and also the emblem of the wattle.
Yeah.
I remember in the 70s dancing the maypole.
Yes.
At my primary school.
Yes.
Hands of Wattle.
Mm.
So it's been in my memory,
yeah.
Wattle. So that's been a great contribution, not only from somebody within our community that's done that, but you've done it not only for our community, but you've done it for the rest of Australian society. that's fantastic.
Yeah, well, I sort of don't think of it that way. All I think of it is like I just did a bit of Commonwealth housekeeping, right? Because all of this was put in train back in about 1910. And they did the coat of arms and they're about to officially recognise Acacia Pycnanthra as the emblem. And then the First World War broke out. And after that, it was put into a drawer. And of course, during that First World War, the Red Cross was selling sprigs of wattle in the Martin Place for the war effort. The only wattle at the time that was prevalent in Sydney was the Cootamundra wattle, and of course it's a winter flowering wattle. So by the 1st of September, they were scratching to get sprigs of wattle to sell. And so the Red Cross asked the Wattle League if they could move the date to the 1st of August temporarily during the First World War. And of course what happened then was after the war, no one bothered to move it back. So kids went to school, and I had a lot of flack from people in the community, right, saying, oh no, no, it's the 1st of August, 1st of August, that's what I learnt when I went to school. And I said, yes, I know, but you know, historically it's not correct, because Wattle Day was supposed to be the Australian first day of spring, just like May Day in Europe, synonymous with springtime. In Australia, we celebrate the first day of spring on the 1st of September, and so Wattle Day is linked with that.
So I suppose it's similar in the war effort to the poppies that
yes.
you have in Europe.
Yes.
So tell me the common name of the wattle that's in our emblem.
Yeah, Acacia Pycnanthra. Acacia Pycnanthra grows in three states, three states and the ACT, South Australia, Victoria and New South Wales. It's what we call a whipstick wattle, so it's got fairly slender stems and it's probably not long-lived in cultivation. It has a very beautiful spray of what we call the ball-type wattle flowers. It was selected as the emblem because Australia was going through a depression. The Acacia Pycnanthra was used for the tanning industry. So because its bark has a very high tannin content, and people saw Acacia Pycnanthra as sort of bringing them out of the doldrums economically. And so that's why they chose Acacia Pycnanthra. I mean, they could have chosen any wattle. The funny thing is that Australians don't care which species it is. To them, the wattle is the emblem and they'll pick any wattle.
So what was the common name you gave me the scientific
name? The golden wattle.
The golden wattle. So what we might do, Maria, is have a little bit of a break.
Yeah.
You can have a glass of water and recharge yourself, and we'll come back to Community Spotlight in a few minutes.
I listen to 2ARM 92.1 FM in the car and at work for great tunes and community news.
And you're back with me, Herb, and Community Spotlight, and I've been talking to a fascinating community member, a real gem in our community, Maria Hitchcock. Back with you, Maria. So we finished off with that fantastic wattle story.
Yeah.
So let's go on to away from plants and into, I think, what you called the first forums in Armidale. Tell me
yes.
about that.
Yes, so probably around about 2017, with two friends, we started up a Q&A program where we ran these Q&A sessions at the bowling club, and we looked at people to be our speakers who were of interest. And so the first one I think we had was Adam Marshall. And he was great, as you can imagine. And we asked people to send in their questions beforehand, and then they'd be given an opportunity to stand up and ask their question on the night. And it was very successful. So we had Barnaby Joyce at one point. We had an executive from Costa's talking about the glasshouses and their development. I think we did one on the rail trail as well, which was very much in its infancy in those days. And Dave Mills of Gyra was our speaker to tell us what was going on there. So, you know, this was a very new development. And it went very well until one of our members decided to leave Armidale and go to Canberra to live. Sort of fell apart because we needed to have the three people running it. So anyway, it then went into recess. I revived it again back at the beginning of 2020. Alan Davies and I had been on Economic Development Advisory Committee of Council, and that was disbanded. And so we decided that we needed to try to keep the community informed of economic development in the area and what was going on. And so we continued the Q&A sessions. As well as that, I published reports. So those reports were pretty well what we'd investigated, and everything was evidence-based. And so we did things like the mall. We walked through the mall and looked at all the shops. People would say, oh, the mall's empty, the mall's empty. But when you actually look at it, we found that there were only two shops that were empty at the time, that the others were all taken up. Mind you, there were a lot of real estate agents and solicitors and so on, not so much retail. And I think that's what people are sort of looking at when they say the mall's empty, that it's the retail aspect of it. I don't know that you'll ever get it back again. But so we went down to the Visitor Information Centre. Council wasn't very happy with us because I published a report saying that the Visitor Information Centre was old-fashioned. So, you know, that was the sort of thing we did. We ran these Q&As, and then we decided that the Q&A format was probably getting a bit tired. So we then turned it into forums. So this time we didn't require anyone to send in their questions beforehand. They could just ask questions from the floor. The first one we did, one of my team members, I've got seven team members, one of my team members is Dr. John Nevin, and he said, oh, you realise that there's a huge GP crisis happening. We're losing GPs, very hard to replace them. A lot of the surgeries are not taking new patients, and I think we should run a forum on the GP crisis. So we did that, and we enlisted the aid of the New England Division of General Practice. And before we knew it, the numbers that had registered were climbing. A lot of local GPs had decided to attend. The ABC 730 report got wind of it, and they asked if they could come up and film it, and that was amazing. So we had this fantastic evening. As a result of that, we sent in a submission to the federal government. The 730 report did a program on it as well. So we realised that maybe what we should be doing is not focusing so much on local issues, but looking at wider issues that would affect the local population. We then decided to do something on the renewable energy zone. We'd already been contacted a number of times by different companies wanting to do consultations with us. We decided to do a forum on the community impact of the renewable energy zone. And of course, you know, we knew that there was dissent in the community. We decided to ask the three mayors, Sam Copeland of Armidale, Rob Bell of Euralla, and the mayor of Walker, Eric Noakes. They would be our speakers. And then we called for, you know, registrations, and we started getting quite a number of registrations. We found out about the splinter groups, the RED for NE, a Responsible Energy Development for New England, which was sort of trying to act as an umbrella group for all these splinter groups, the Voices for Walker and a few others, and Batting for Burralong and so on. Anyway, so we had a very, very good evening. Very good evening. Very civilised, fantastic. Everyone complimented us on the fact that, you know, the evening was run in such a well-managed way. You know, then after that, we ran one on wind farms and one on solar farms.
So you were referring to this as a forum.
Yes.
But this is under a different auspice. This was under the New England Vision 2030 that you developed in 2020.
Yeah.
And correct if I'm wrong, it's basically a volunteer organisation?
Yes, it's a volunteer non-profit organisation. As I said, we have 17 members, all highly respected members in the community, fantastic scholarship, we're all retired, and we all bring an amazing amount of expertise. So, you know, from medical, historical, I'm the environmental spokesperson, we've got senior public servant, former councillor, you know, so we cover a big range of interests and background.
Basically, you fund these things by a contribution, a $5 contribution to attend at the door, nothing else.
Exactly, nothing else, because we wanted to remain completely independent. So nobody could say we were being influenced by any other organisation. We try to be as neutral as we can, so we don't, you know, we try not to take a stance. What we try to do is help, you know, people who require or organisations that require assistance. Renewable Energy Zone, we were, people said, oh, you know, you should have had people on your panel from, you know, these other opposition groups. And I said, no, it's not a debate. What we're trying to do is give you the information. So we have specialists, we have people who know the background, who are aware of what's going on, and they are there to answer your questions.
So anybody can come along to these New England Vision 2030. How often do you run them and where are they held?
Right, so they're always held at the Armidale Bowling Club, and we'd like to thank the Bowling Club for giving us in-kind support. They've been absolutely fantastic. So we try to run them during the warmer months. We're very open to what's going on in the community at the time. So we ran the renewable energy ones at the beginning of this year and the end of last year, and then we decided that over the winter months we would just meet with lots of stakeholders and inform ourselves of what's going on in the community, and if something comes up then we'll run a forum. We've planned three forums for the end of the year. The first one is going to be meet the candidates for the local government election. So prospective councillors will be able to come along to that, and we'll open that up to the community. We won't ask for a donation at all at that point, which we sort of normally ask for a donation at the door, but this one will be free. People won't have to register. They can just walk through the door. The second one that we're planning is one on the Yazidis in Armidale. They've been here for 5 years now, and I think people would really want to know how they've settled in, what are the problems, you know, is there anything that needs to be done to sort of help them along. And the third one we're thinking of, and we need to confirm this, we're thinking of running one on UNE and how UNE sees its future in this area over the next, say, 5 years. So, you know, I think that'll be a really good program.
The Armidale Bolo Club, fantastic club here in Armidale, and we thank them for supporting the non-profit New England Visions 2030 in your forums. So you've got three planned. They'll be promoted through what network so people can get onto that?
So we have a website, and every Friday morning I do an update. I also advertise through the council's What's On page, through the events page, and so we get out there to the community, and my mantra is share, 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 you know, through Facebook pages and things like that. So getting the message out to everyone.
So people will be well aware when these next three come up.
Yes.
after Wattle Day.
Yes,
please. After Wattle Day on the 1st of September. So tell me, what else have New England Visions been looking at?
As I said, we're open to things that just come up. And we were made aware, you know, a couple of months ago about the problem with the New England Rail Trail in council. Everyone had assumed that it was just a matter of form that had been approved back in 2020. The council had, you know, put a little bit of money towards the business plan, and Adani had done a very, very good business plan. Council had applied for funding and it was all systems go. And then we found that there was going to be an amendment to the motion to start. And of course, council's under time pressure because they've got to try to complete this first section by the 31st of March. Otherwise, they'll lose the grant. What we couldn't have was a delay.
So what, in your perspective, and I suppose perspective from New England Vision, why is the rail trail the way to go?
Okay, so what we've got is a corridor that sat idle for 35 years. It's an asset that's not being utilised, and we can see from other rail trails across Australia that this is a big money maker. This is a way of getting tourists into the area. And so when we found out that there was a problem with this, because New England Visions is all about economic development, you know, we're really keen on promoting economic development and for the well-being of the district. And we knew there was support for this out there, but we needed a numerical value to it. And so that's why we started the petition, and we were gobsmacked with the results. So 1,000 signatures the first day, 2,000 in 2 days, 3,000 in 3 days, 4,000 in 4 days. We couldn't believe it. And obviously there was so much support out there. The silent majority was voting, you know, in this petition. We knew that the community really, really wanted it, and we were very happy to be able to assist with that.
So the Mwoolumbah example has always come up when I speak to people about the rail trail. They've only got a short section. Is it 28 kilometres?
24, I think, at this stage. But, of course, it's a much longer trail. It's going to cover four LGAs, four different councils involved. There's a lot of planning still going on. I mean, these things don't happen overnight, right? And there's funding that has to happen. But you have to make a start somewhere. And that's why Public Works decided that, you know, Armidale to Demerick was a good way to start.
Well, the Mwoolumbah example, back to that, is that they are gobsmacked. You mentioned you're gobsmacked. Gobsmacked of how many people,
yes,
once they've opened their trail. It's only been going 6 or 7 months.
Yeah.
I know Mwoolumbah is a different climate than us, but regardless, 6 or 7 months, they've had thousands of people,
yes,
come up to try the rail trail, and there's a lot of social media about how positive it is.
Yes, and the lovely thing about rail trails is that they cover all of those little inland towns and villages, and so the whole community benefits. And we know of people who've invested in B&B accommodation all the way along the prospective New England rail trail, and it's a big money spinner. It's amazing. So New Zealand found this, right, with their Otago trail, and it was a similar area to this, you know, agricultural area, grazing and so on. And they've done enormously well out of it. So they get international people as well.
So, yes, I talked to John Glatley a couple of weeks ago, and we talked about connecting a branch line to the current rail trail, which is going from Armidale to Jumeric platform, off to Jumeric Dam, which would,
yes,
be a great value add. People could actually bike out, go out, catch a fish,
yeah,
cook it up, or take some sausages out, and with the fantastic barbecues that the council's now got out there. So it's sort of like a smart move, is you've actually got other avenues to actually add to the rail trail.
Yeah, so there's an active transport strategy in at the moment, and of course the state government wants people to get out there and be more active, because obviously that keeps them out of doctor surgeries and hospitals. But you've got to have a safe place to ride. I've done a lot of cycling in my time, and I know that, you know, if you're riding on the road, you always run the risk that you're going to be knocked off your bike, and especially on these country roads. Roads, you know, people do travel at fairly high speeds. It's always a worry. So my husband and I have actually stopped cycling now, and we can't wait for the rail trail to start up.
Well, it's great that it's going forward. And somebody also mentioned that The rail trial, the start of the rail trial, won't be very far away from the Armidale Secondary College.
Absolutely. And you can imagine, you know, 100 kids on sports afternoon taking their bikes across the road, out of the gate, across the road, over the lines, across the park, and you're straight on to the rail trail. And it's an 18-kilometre round trip. They could do that easily in an afternoon. And so you've got all these kids, and it won't just be the secondary college, it'll be all the schools, because they'll see this as a brilliant place, you know, for their sports afternoon to bring the kids with their bikes.
So it's almost like the more you think about the rail trail, the more you actually come up with who's going to use it, the way it's going to be used. The exciting thing is that now we've got the go-ahead to move ahead and get that first section. I'm pretty sure people will be really happy that we've gone down this road, and it's been a fantastic thing. I might finish up now, Maria.
Yeah, okay.
It's been a fantastic time. You are real gem of our community.
Thank you.
And you did mention that somebody had said that you're a terrier.
Yeah.
And I said I didn't want to actually say that, but I will, in that you're just so committed to improving our lot here in Armidale,
mm-hmm.
Community-minded.
Yeah.
Everything you've done, particularly the wattle. I think it's a great story about the wattle.
Thank you.
So thanks again, and thanks for all your efforts.
Thanks, Herb.
You're a real gem. Thanks for coming in.
Broadcast, then podcast. If you missed it or want to hear it again, then visit our webpage, 2arm.net.au/podcast.
I listen to 2ARM, 92.1 FM, in the car and at work, for great tunes and community news.